Hello, everyone, and such a warm welcome to all of you. What a robust and wonderful global learning community we've gathered here for teaching peace in schools, cultivating restorative school communities. And tonight's session, of course, is session 3. And we are going to be continuing on this journey until April 14th. And we're actually in the works looking at putting on a final session beyond that, where we have a learning community sharing session where people can share their own thoughts and reflections and ideas from what they've gained, from what we've all gained together here at Teaching Peace in Schools. And I just want to thank the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, that's nacrj.org, and the Peace Alliance, peacealliance.org, for co-hosting this extraordinary opportunity to have an overview glimpse of modalities and practices, and to also build an online community of practitioners and academics and those who are interested in cultivating a restorative community in one form or another, whether it's a school community or beyond. We welcome you tonight, and I'm very pleased and honored, as always, to host you and to set a tone of exploration and learning with you. My name is Molly Rowan Leach, and I serve as the Peace Alliance's Restorative Justice Fellow. I'm also a broadcast and print journalist, and I host the ongoing dialogue forum and platform called Restorative Justice on the Rise, that has been in motion since 2011 and is an open source inspired space for people to come together and hear from voices across the globe in peace building and restorative practices. So again, a warm welcome to you, and we're going to dive right in tonight with our very special guest faculty, and I'll introduce him briefly in a moment and then let him take us away. But just a few notes about our course. If you're just joining us now, you can go back in to the last couple weeks' sessions, and you can find audio and resources and links from Kay Pranis and Carolyn Boyce Watson's session, and also from Nancy Riestenberg and Rita Alfred's session last week. Now, when you signed up, you should have received a link to our main site, which is Teach course page. That's teach/course/page. That's at the peacealliance.org website. So you would enter peacealliance.org and then teach/course/page. And peace is the way is your password. And I have that up on the screen share for you right now so that you can look at that link and jot it down if you don't already have it. Also tonight, I'd like to just note that this is an audio-based presentation, and our slides will be minimal and informational. And also a big thank you to all of our partners who have joined us in distributing this course information and sharing it to a global community. We couldn't have done it without all of you. So a very big thank you to the partners that are listed in this simple slideshow tonight on our screen share. Remember, you can download your audios and all of the resource links, again, at that main course website. You can listen to them at any time and keep those as a part of the package that came with your registration. Also, just a quick reminder that you, if you haven't already received your certificate for submitting CE or CEUs in your local community and your district, you can request that by emailing our course administrative manager, Katrina, at katrina@peacealliance.org. That's K-A-T-R-I-N-A at peacealliance.org. So tonight's session is a very special session with someone that I've had the good fortune of working with and getting to know over the past, actually, 4 years now. And I just really have such a respect for Dominic Barter a deep respect for his courage and his willingness to, as he describes it, walk towards conflict. And tonight's session is titled Building Systems to Promote Dialogue, How Restorative Circles Support Community Responses to Conflict. And I know that many of you already are familiar with Dominic. Those of you who are not yet familiar with Dominic's work and Restorative Circles work across the globe are in for a big treat tonight. And I know that given that we've kind of walked with Carolyn and Kay's sessions into Nancy and Rita's from looking at the deeper roots of what cultivating a restorative lens means to how we actualize that within our systems. I find that this is a perfect flow to introduce you now and welcome very warmly Dominic Barter. Welcome, Dom.
Thank you so much, Molly. And thank you for doing all the work and the organizing so that we can just so simply dial in and turn up this evening and all be connected in this amazing way. I like to always mention that there's all this background work going on whenever a group of people can meet so simply, because I think making it visible can help us understand something about what's involved in building restorative systems before we can do the actual work of sitting down together and dialoguing. So thank you so much for making all that so easy. And it's a great pleasure to be with you all this evening. I'm sitting here in Rio. It's 10 o'clock at night here. It's the end of summer, but it's still about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's still pretty warm. We've been having really dramatic evening storms every night for the last 2 weeks. And it's kind of miraculous that tonight there is no big storm. So I was a little bit concerned that there'd be a lot of lightning and thunder sounds in the background and maybe flickering electricity and internet access, but it all seems very smooth. And it's just wonderful to be able to spend this time with you all and see if we can deepen our understanding of what are the conditions involved in creating the kind of atmosphere in learning spaces in society that is so essential for people to really be able to develop their full potential. And a simple way of saying that for me is that one of the conditions in to create a sense of well-being that promotes learning is that we understand conflict as being just a normal part of social relationships, rather than the inherited idea we have that conflict is something which is dangerous or scary or destructive, and that therefore it needs to be repressed or ignored or marginalized or even resolved. Even perhaps the idea that conflict needs to be resolved is in some way connected to this worry about conflict, this fear of conflict. And my experience with young people is consistently that their worry is not about conflict. Their worry is that adults are worried about conflict. They know that conflict is a normal part of life, and their concern is that we have no effective strategies for really engaging with conflict. Almost everything that we do around conflict is based on our fear of it and our desire to try and make it go away. And as I think we'll see, what happens when we try to marginalize or repress or ignore conflict is that it generously gets louder in order to compensate for our deafness. And that loudness is the thing that we've become scared of. That loudness starts to impose upon us. And that's how we start to get into situations of pain and even in situations of danger and aggression with each other. So before we dive into what we might learn about how to build spaces that are safe for dialogue within schools, I just wanted to pause a moment. I was looking yesterday at this phrase, teaching peace in schools, and it occurred to me that we might actually look at that from two distinct angles. The one that I imagine most of you think of most easily, because it's the one that society promotes, is the idea that there's schools, there's no question about that, and then schools are conflictual, and anyone who's been a teacher like me, or a student like all of us have been, I imagine, or most of us in schools, or even held some kind of administrative role, which I've also done. Anyone who's been in any one of those roles will know that schools can be full of wonderful moments, but also that tension can arise in all kinds of different ways, sometimes surprising ways and sometimes predictable ways. And but when it does, it interrupts the other activities that we're doing, mainly the learning activities. And so we're often really interested in diminishing those interruptions. And even though we perhaps, if we sat down and thought about it, realize that this is maybe not a good idea, we still often end up, in practical terms, dealing with questions around control. So we're trying to control conflict, and then soon suddenly we're trying to control behavior, and then suddenly we're trying to control human beings. And if we really sat down and thought about this, we'd kind of work out that controlling human beings really doesn't work, and when you're trying, you get really miserable. The people you're trying to control get miserable, and you get miserable trying. And yet, that's often the kind of situation we're in. So when we talk about teaching peace in schools, we maybe assume that teaching peace actually is kind of a nice way of saying learning how to control human beings so that their behavior does not threaten or interrupt other people's well-being and learning. But another way to look at this would be actually to question, what do we mean by school in the first place? And then we're not so much teaching peace in schools as we're actually interested in what would schools be like that by their very nature, by the day-to-day ethos that orients them, they are in fact automatically promoting a vision of human society which is based on the highest forms of relational intelligence. It's based on understanding that controlling human beings is just a game set up for suffering, mutual suffering, and that really what we're looking at, if we're creating an environment which is about nurturing human potential and understanding, is not controlling behavior, but understanding ourselves and each other in relationship. So then teaching peace in schools is almost like saying the same thing twice. So even though I imagine that most of the examples we'll be looking at are a little bit more connected to the first understanding of that phrase, because that's what most of us who work in education experience on a day-to-day basis, I don't want to forget that second possibility. I don't want to forget that the potential that restorative practices bring to education is not simply to make the current systems of learning function better, but maybe ultimately, if we really understand the deeper meaning, the deeper call that restorative work is inviting us to, is actually that restorative practices are part of a wider, deeper transformation of those learning spaces, so that they actually start to look really quite different from how they are today. And for me, a clue to doing that is simply to remember what the word school means, or what it was invented to originally mean. And sometimes I joke, but it's not really a joke, that it might be a good idea if you work in education, if you sit down before you hear this, especially if you've not opened a dictionary ever and actually looked to see what the word school means. Because the word school, at least in my understanding from its Greek origin, refers to a gathering of people in a space in which all the rules have been suspended and no laws are imposed. There's no imposition. All prior understandings, agreements, or rules have been suspended. And that just strikes me as quite amazing when I think of the schools that I went to as a student, and I think of the schools that I visited in my restorative work, and I think of the schools that I've taught in. Schools originally, because they're designed for learning, needed to be spaces where we could freely explore and question everything. For you to really be able to get into contact with the new and the eternal, understand yourself and others and the universe in all the myriad ways that there are to do that, then you needed a place where all the normal rules were paused so that you could question everything and really go into everything deeply. When you look at school from that perspective, then in my understanding, restorative work is perfectly matched, because what we do in restorative work, in my practice, is not to say, oh, there's conflict, what a problem, quick, let's throw this process at it. Instead, what we say is, wow, conflict, fantastic, that's feedback on how we're living together. That's feedback, perhaps, that some of our agreements are out of date and need updating. It's feedback that perhaps some of our agreements aren't as widely held as we thought they were. It's feedback that perhaps the conditions that we need to care for everybody's inclusion and well-being are not functioning as well as we thought they would. So conflict is an opportunity to create a greater sense of connectedness, a greater sense of community well-being and cohesion. It's an opportunity and not a problem. And restorative practices aim to create the conditions not to make conflict go away, but enable conflict to express itself fully so that we can actually understand what's going on, what is behind this pain or what is behind this confusion, what is the message behind behavior which perhaps has reached such a level of desperation in its attempt to be articulated that it's been reduced to hurting people as a way of calling attention to the fact that something isn't okay. So by responding restoratively, we don't attempt to isolate perpetrators, identifying the wrongdoers and seeing them as being the source of our difficulty, but rather we see the individuals involved in any particular conflict as manifesting a dynamic that actually belongs to the whole. It belongs to the whole school community, or belongs to the whole family, or the whole institution, the whole workplace, or the whole city when we're looking at restorative practices used in court systems. So when we understand school in that sense, restorative practices make a lot of sense. And when we understand school in the way that most schools are set up these days, there's a creative tension there between the origin of what school's intended to do and the modern day situation that many of us find ourselves in, the education systems find themselves in which restorative practices often appear to be a way of smoothing over some of the knottiest problems that we face. So here we have an opportunity for restorative practices to be, as it were, a Trojan horse for deeper transformation in the school. But the challenge that the very existence of the school on a systemic level, political level, historical level, is encouraging us all the time to use restorative practices to in fact manage people, to manage their expressions that we find in some way disruptive, rather than understanding that disruption as a creative contribution to school life and an invitation to transform. So I'm curious, after setting up the conversation that I'd like to have with you all, how that all sounds to you. I'm wondering if there's anyone out there who has something that they'd like to reflect back to me on what you've heard me say, or that you'd like to perhaps contextualize within your practical experience of working with young people or working in education.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Dominic. I really appreciated what you just shared. I have to repeat it. conflict is an opportunity to create a greater sense of cohesiveness. I had to tweet that while we were going here. I would like to welcome you all into the conversation. Please press 1 on your telephone keypad to signal if you'd like to join the conversation here. Educators working within the field, especially if you have comments right now and feedback, we'll open up for a little bit here. Welcome, Susan. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, Dominic, I'm going to look forward to playing and replaying this audio, because I found myself on my tippy toes with what words you were going to say next. So I think really what I'm wanting to express is just how deeply, how much resonance I'm experiencing in what you are sharing and how I yearn to help create community that looks at school the way your definition that you've shared provides. And yeah, I'm just still very, very touched right now. It all seems so big sometimes for me and my work, and then I step back and then I see these little miracles. So I'm just so grateful for what you are doing and for this program. So I'm complete. Thank you.
Thank you,
Susan,
so much.
Would you mind sharing where? Thank you, Susan. And would you mind sharing where you're from? What part of the world?
Yes, I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I'm a co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Compassionate Communication Network.
Thank you so much, Susan. Let's see. Let's go to another. Okay, Sandra, welcome. You're live.
Hi, I'm calling from Wisconsin. The Latin word educare for education means to bring forth, to draw out mm-hmm. of a child and nurture that imminence. What is imminent in the child, and let it lead. Let the child lead with us facilitating.
Mm-hmm.
In all my experience, through teaching in the Milwaukee Public Schools and observing other schools, 7 districts around Milwaukee subbing, I see, in my opinion, about 80%, 85% of the students miserable because they are being told what to learn. And it's called the banking system of education, that somehow, somewhere, people decided, well, we fill up the child with all this information we think they should have, prescribed information, and then we ask them to play it back on a test so we know that we're successful. And if the scores are high, that shows us we're successful. And what I've experienced is soon after the test, the kids have information is gone because it's not relevant. So we've replaced relevancy in education with rigor. And I don't like that word because it feels so inhuman. To stop a process of that, I don't know, it's so large, it's so systemic. There are some project-based learning schools starting up in my state, but they still have mandates that are overriding that exploration that children could really enjoy. There's some exploration, but it's minimal because they still have to meet certain standards from the state. Feels very frustrating. I love it that Tim Ryan submitted his Bill 850 for now funding for emotional and social learning. But then again, as you're saying, Dominic, this might be used to keep maintaining control so the kids absorb the information better without disruption. It's pretty, I feel very sad and dismayed. And I'm thinking there is a revolution underway, I think, before the end of the year. There's so much stress, I can't imagine it continuing. I think there's going to be breaking down. People going through the day with trying at the speed that's expected of them and all the things, the content that is expected to be put at the kids. There's a tremendous amount of stress. I think it was WebMD magazine, November 2015, that said stress for our youth in schools is at an all-time high. And it's mm-hmm. because of this push of prescribed information to have them get it and then take the tests, which has nothing to do with education, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of the same things that you've seen, and I resonate with your concern, and perhaps I'm hearing in your voice a kind of sense of tiredness and desperation, the fact that it is like this, and that it continues to be like this for now, even as I also hear you sounding hopeful about possibilities of more systemic change.
Yeah.
And one of the
I'm hopeful. I guess I want change fast because it's hurting people. It's just hurting people,
yeah.
Especially our little ones.
Yeah, one of the annoying little phrases that I've kind of invented for myself to help me understand how to develop the restorative circles work that I want to share with you today in contexts like this is that restorative work is too urgent to rush. So my desire for change to happen quickly is just like yours. And I found that any attempt for me to rush ahead is actually counterproductive. And it is exactly because this work is so urgent, so needed, and because there's so much pain and stress and disconnection resulting from the way that we're currently responding to the different challenges that education brings up and that conflict in education specifically brings up, because all of this is so urgent, we need to learn to actually move forward only with really concrete, specific, doable steps and together, rather than in little isolated ways or motivated by ideological positions that separate us from others. So one of the things that I'm hoping to share with you this evening are some different considerations that you might bear in mind when looking at the wider situation, which we just heard you describe. We begin to question, how could restorative work, which of course is only a very small piece of all the complexity that goes on in a school community, but how could restorative work function as a model for a different relational space? How could restorative work create a little pause in the busyness of the day-to-day experience of a school, any school, no matter how it is, including in Brazil, for example, all the different schools we have in youth prisons, which are some of the most desperate examples of education that you can imagine. But even in those schools, what would it be like to be able to create a space in which restorative practices could function, a dedicated space, a space that's designed just for them, in the same way that the classrooms have been designed for a particular kind of, as you said, reminding us of Paulo Freire, another Brazilian contributor to the world, this banking system of education, because that's how the classrooms have been designed. They've been designed to accumulate knowledge, not necessarily to foster learning, although accumulating knowledge, of course, is part of learning, but there's so much else to do with learning as well. Just like those classrooms have been designed for that, how can we create specific dedicated spaces that are designed for us to come together and dialogue, designed for us to share power, are designed for us not just to speak but to listen, and not just to speak opinion but to see if we can recover our ability to speak truth. So even though restorative practices will be only a small contribution to what some of us would like to see as a wider transformation in education, yet still they can be a contribution which has a lot of internal integrity and a contribution which serves as a small island of possibility, not a possibility that sounds nice in theory but no one can really imagine how to put it into practice, but a living, tangible place where things are different, that you can check in every day, and that in my experience, pulses from within a school, no matter how suffering that school community is, pulses out, emanates out, shines out like a beacon, a different possibility, and starts to seep down the corridors, seep through the playground, seep underneath the classroom doors, into the staff room, into admin, and just remind people that their original idea of going into education was to create a situation where people could genuinely develop their critical capacities, where they could question and understand by connecting dots, by connecting ideas, by seeking, observing patterns and understanding how things flow, rather than, as so much of our education has become, something which is involved in separating us and teaching us simply to consume the past rather than to discover the present and question ourselves about the future. So there are two main elements to this that I found. It's very, very simple, but often I notice that when restorative work is done in school, these elements are either only partially applied or one of them really isn't applied at all. So I name these two elements. First of all, the restorative system, and that's the bit that is really far less known and far less applied. And then there is the restorative practice in itself, which thankfully is known more and more present in all kinds of places in society, but really immense growth in the last 15 years in the field of education. Really spectacular, wonderful, wonderful things have happened. So much diversity of practices, so much research going on, so many fantastic people dedicating themselves to that work. And that work itself involves specific dynamics. And sometimes I've noticed that those dynamics are less strong in some of those practices than I think they could be. So one of those dynamics would be the very circular nature of the restorative practice. And by the circular nature, I don't just mean the way that we organize chairs. Fundamentally, I mean the way that we arrange, the way that we share, the way that we commit to a certain orientation of power. So when we talk about restorative practices being circle practices, what we're talking about is shared power. Because it's only when power is shared, that is, when our institutional labels or our different ages and life experiences or our different roles within the school community are present, but they're not the primary place from which we're speaking. When we're sharing power in that particular way, then we actually have a circle practice. And we know that because we've created the conditions in which it is safe for people to speak the truth. And not just any truth, but particularly those truths that are often unwelcome. The truths that are often silent, we're often silently being requested, if not demanded, not to speak. And when those truths are really silenced effectively, systematically by the society, then they're not even actually being silenced. They're being made invisible. We're actually being subtly but clearly and consistently taught to forget that we actually know that something could be different because we're aware of the truth that informs us that how it is currently is not functioning and that there is a different way to do things. So just this simple act of creating a circle is in fact really, really profound and goes far, far beyond the way that we set up the room. Another one of the elements that I notice is present to varying degrees in the restorative practice, but for me, it's essential to create the conditions for it to be present as much as we possibly can, is dialogue. Not dialogue meant as simply another word for conversation, synonym for talking together, but dialogue is a technical term, because in restorative practice, dialogue is one of our key terms. It has a very specific definition, like any trade has key words that it uses in very specific ways. And dialogue is one of those for restorative practitioners. The definition of dialogue that I most enjoy is the one that comes from perhaps the very first person to study dialogue from an academic perspective, really, really deeply, and that was Martin Buber. And Martin Buber described dialogue as a conversation between equals whose ending is unknown. A conversation between equals whose ending is unknown. And there's something about that ending being unknown which for me is very, very evocative. It suggests that in a dialogue, again, there's shared power because there's no one there to tell us where we're going or when we've got there. There's no one who knows the way. We're traveling together. And what that means is not simply that we're expressing ourselves, when we talk about restorative justice, right from the very beginning of our understanding of restorative justice in the 70s, it was clear how important it was to create a space where everyone could speak, particularly those people who are normally excluded or whose voices are excluded from our normal response to justice, our normal formal justice systems and our informal justice systems, which kind of reproduce the court setting in, at home, on the street corner, in our workplaces, and of course, equally in schools. Speaking, especially for those whose voices were silenced, was always a key part of understanding the change that restorative justice is bringing. But in dialogue, it's just as significant, and sometimes maybe even more significant, that we learn how to listen, so that we don't move forwards alone simply through speech, but we only take steps forwards on this journey together. And that means that we've only completed a step when, yes, I've spoken, but then when you've understood what I said in the spirit in which I meant it. And that's particularly important because in so many places in society these days, we have started to take each other literally. So we've started to lose our ability to really appreciate the context and the subtlety of what people mean, and instead we're focused on what people say. If people slip up, if our politicians slip up, or even family members slip up with just one or two key words, if a student in school just slips up and says one word on a supposed list of words that shouldn't be spoken, then suddenly that person has created a crime, that has committed a crime, an infraction. They've broken some law or some agreement. And I say agreement in inverted commas because they've often had absolutely no say whatsoever in this so-called agreement. It's been imposed by other groups of people. And normally, those people are people who historically have greater access to power and privilege than they do. So our ability to dialogue depends on our ability to listen, and that listening is not just to words, but it's fundamentally to meaning. That means that we can actually listen to silence. We can listen to the meaning implicit in someone staring at the floor, or staring at the wall, or staring at the ceiling. We do if we allow ourselves to have the capacity to understand the meaning of someone shrugging their shoulders or someone sighing and looking in the other direction. We know a lot about what facial expressions may be telling us about what our use of hands, gestures, feet, breathing, so many different ways that we communicate. And in restorative circles or restorative practices in general, these are all, in my understanding, fully legitimate forms of expression. There's also fully legitimate forms of expression which involve words which in other places in society we might object to, we might ask people not to say. The really classic examples in English are that I could get arrested if I walked up to a policeman and said the word fuck, but I probably wouldn't get arrested if I walked up to a policeman and said fornicate, even though those two words mean exactly the same thing. The difference between them is that the first word is Anglo-Saxon, and the second word is Latin and came to English through the French. Why do we have two words to say the same thing? Because 1,000 years ago, the French invaded England. And when they did so, they divided the culture and the language and the political distribution of power between those people with a French origin and their language coming from Latin, who were in the dominant position, and those people whose language was Anglo-Saxon, coming through German roots, and their position was inferior. And 1,000 years later, language still speaks to us about power. And students in school can get into a lot of trouble if they use Anglo-Saxon words to describe parts of the body or different body functions, whereas they could get a good mark in a biology test if they describe exactly those same parts of our anatomy or those same biological functions using words with a Latin origin. So when we go into a restorative space and we're listening not just to words but to meaning, I find it's really important if we're going to deepen our practice of dialogue for us to remember that marginalized people tend to use marginalized language. And that if we often, with the best of intentions, accidentally create lists of acceptable and unacceptable terms, or forms of expression which are acceptable and forms which are unacceptable, like silence, for example, or sighing or tutting or looking at someone in a way that suggests that you don't believe anything they're saying, or that we recover our ability to recognize and legitimize, validate those forms of expression, both verbal and nonverbal, and understand that in a restorative space, we're not primarily focused on the words people use. We're primarily focused on the meaning that those words and those actions might have. When we recover our ability to listen to meaning, then the degree to which the space becomes a space of dialogue, in my experience, increases greatly. Luckily, we have a word for all that it took me about 2 minutes to describe just now, a much simpler word that can be used as a bookmark to remember that ability to be able to listen to meaning. And that word is intelligence. The word intelligence is made of two parts, inter, that's the prefix, that means between, and leggeri. Leggeri basically refers to lines, like the lines if you're taking notes in a notebook right now. There might be thin blue lines on the piece of paper that you're writing on so that you can write in straight lines. So the word leggeri is connected to the word line. And leggeri originally were pieces of wood that the Roman stonemasons used, the Italian stonemasons used, in order to be able to keep a straight line when they were carving the Roman numerals and the letters into stone, one of those big triumphant stone buildings that the Romans were so fond of building everywhere that they went. So intellegere means literally, intelligence means literally, between the lines. It suggests that intelligence is not a capacity that we learn in a university. It's got nothing to do with having letters after your name or getting diplomas. Intelligence is being aware, being sharp, being on the ball. It's street wisdom, street knowledge. And it means the capacity to work out what people mean despite what they say. To search for the meaning either behind the words or between the words. And it really relates to the way that many of us enjoy to use language. We don't like to say everything in really explicit terms. What we really enjoy doing is suggesting things, insinuating things. It's like I'll say half of what I mean. I'll kind of meet you halfway as a way to find out if you're really paying attention or if you're really interested in this conversation. Ultimately, if you're really interested in me. If you are, then you'll meet me in the middle. I'll suggest what it is that I mean, and you'll come to meet me, and you'll complete the meaning. And together we're co-creating meaning. So when in our restorative practices, we're fully exploring the potential that dialogue offers us for understanding and transformation, what we're doing is co-creating meaning. We're sitting together, not simply to speak and listen, but we're sitting together to see if we can actually create an understanding about what occurred, what it meant, and what we want to do next that is shared, that doesn't reinforce our sense of separate and distinct identities, but also doesn't eclipse that sense as it moves towards a sense of shared meaning. So these are the two places that I'd like to look at, that sense of there being an agreement, a restorative system that creates a dedicated space that we can all meet in, and then the actual practice itself and the extent to which that practice is making the most of the potential that we have for creating a true circle, that is, a space of shared power, and creating a dynamic where we're actually in dialogue. So we're reflecting back what it is that we hear people say until they're satisfied. Not that we've managed to get the words, but that we've managed to get the underlying logic, what they really mean, what they're trying to say. So again, after having shared that, I'm really curious to see if we're on the same page, if you're following me, if there are reflections that you'd like to make, doubts that are coming up, something that you'd like to share from your experience, which maybe challenges or contests what I'm saying, or reinforces it or adds something to it.
And just a reminder to please press 1 on your keypad. I refreshed the hands up. I know there were some people that had their hand up that we didn't get a chance to share with yet. So if you would please press 1 again, and then we can make sure we get to you hopefully this evening and keep up this conversation. So let's see here. Welcome to David. Your mic is now open. Welcome, David. Where are you from?
Hi, I'm David Farron from Wisconsin. Well, we have had a rough time in education in Wisconsin, but I'd like to ask Dominic more about the personal journey. It has to do with, in university, Maslow's hierarchy of needs includes power and control. And I'm also familiar with other psychologists that adopted similar terms. And what I see a lot of is we have a systemic pressure to try to maintain control over students. And the process of, you know, trying to maintain an atmosphere where there's instruction that can be heard by everyone present, and the expectation that that students follow those rules are imposed upon them. And you can also see the children reaching out for their own need for power and control, and seeking that in ways that don't sit well with that model. And, you know, I work within other environments that than are typical. I work in gymnasiums. I support students in that physical education environment, but there's another teacher who's leading the class, and I'm dealing with students who are having special needs. And in that context, you know, I'm always torn between recognizing the child's needs and the instructor's needs and what they perceive as their class's needs. And so I want to ask Dominic about his personal process, his journey towards being able to hold that space within a circle, and also within the society that has pressures that create an atmosphere that makes that more challenging.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you for very much what you do as well, especially I don't know too much about the situation in different states in the U.S., but if you've been having a challenging time, then I'm even more grateful that you're still doing what you're doing. I have no problem with words like control and power when they refer to our strong need to be able to directly influence the conditions around us and to be able to care for our own well-being and the well-being of those we love and are connected to. The question is when the use of that power or the exercise of that control becomes one that actually attempts to repress the expression of conflict, when conflict is in fact feedback about the extent to which particular social systems or relationships are no longer functioning to create well-being. They're no longer meeting the needs that they were originally designed to meet and that the titles that they have claim that they're trying to meet. So, for example, when the justice system is no longer creating an experience of justice and therefore no longer just itself, or when the health system is no longer actually creating health and well-being and therefore is no longer healthy itself. And when the education system or the schooling system is no longer creating these spaces of exploration and investigation that promote the furthering of our understanding of ourselves and the universe, or, as our second speaker said, no longer bringing out or allowing to flow out from us, as the word education suggests, all the potential that we have to contribute. So my personal journey in this was, first of all, originally through being a student and being fascinated by the institution that I was in and it's everything that it could provide for me, some of which I absolutely adored, and everything which it attempted to diminish or repress in me, which I was absolutely outraged about, even at a very young age. Going through that process, then going into the process of teaching in different ways, and eventually going into a middle school and a high school and teaching in there, and then my daughter growing up and seeing her go through her different schools and accompanying her in that process, and now in the process of actually beginning to co-create a school of our own. And in the meantime, spending time through my restorative work with several different education departments on state levels and municipal levels, and going into hundreds of schools and observing what's happening, spending a lot of time hanging out with students, hanging out with teachers, parents, administrators, hanging out with those key members of the school community that are often the most forgotten, which are people who monitor corridors, people who cook and serve meals, people who hold that big bunch of keys, checking that the lights are out at the end of the day and locking up. All the different members of the school community, and then the wider community around it. And just listening and listening and listening, and seeing that consistently people have a very, very clear sense of what works when conflict emerges in these communities. We actually have a lot of intelligence about this because it's happened to us a lot. We've observed it a lot. We spend an awful lot of time talking about conflict, talking about its consequences, and wondering with each other what we should do about particular conflicts. So I found that people have a great reservoir of understanding of what works well and what doesn't work well when the question is, how do we get along, particularly when things get painful? So I love asking those two questions, a way of introducing the process of developing these dedicated spaces for conflict. I personally don't see restorative work as being nearly as effective when it is a conclusion or a response as it is when it's a question, when it's an inquiry. So personally, I don't arrive at a school district or at a school itself with any idea that I have, with any sense that I have an idea of what people should do, because I may not be yet an integral part of that community. I may not be going through what they're going through just yet. So the first thing I want to do is hang out with them. I want to see if simply through passing time with them in the different ways in which they go through their day can begin to open me up to a sense of what life is like for them. And as that begins to happen, and the first kind of little flashes of trust or curiosity or a sense of connectedness start to emerge, and they usually do that just through normal life experiences, laughing at the things that we both find funny, connects us, reminds us that we have something that we share. Mourning the things that we both find upsetting or fearful does exactly the same thing. And that within that process of beginning to establish relationships, these questions often emerge. Well, what do you do at the moment that works well? When conflict gets tricky, when things get painful, when feelings are really hurt, when people start to get sore with each other or separate from each other or are intent on needing to defend themselves from each other or attack the other person as a way of defending themselves. What is it that currently works well? And at the same time, equally, what do you know that doesn't work so well? And the reason I want to do that is exactly because I want to connect to people's power. I want to connect to people's ability to actually control in the good sense, to create, to influence, to develop and promote the conditions that they want, the lifestyle and the relationships that they found are most effective in caring for us all and meeting our needs. And often what will happen out of that conversation is that the response to a third question will emerge. And that third question is the really juicy one. That's when we actually begin, in my experience, to create something new, to create a restorative system. And that third question is about what people would like to see happen. Okay, so they've shared their wisdom about what works and what doesn't work. Now, if things were different, if things were designed the way that they think it should be, if we really made the most of the wisdom that they have, what would be happening? What would this look like? What would the procedures be? What would the journey be from the moment in which someone first identifies that someone's actions are creating pain or diminishing well-being. The minute that red flag goes up, the minute one person pushes someone else, or a sharp word is said in the staff room, or someone makes one of those jokes that actually isn't a joke at all, or if someone's department receives less resources than someone else's, or voices begin to be raised, it doesn't matter if they're being raised between four-year-olds or they're being raised between 40-year-olds. The minute that red flag goes up, what would we be doing if we were really making the most of our understanding of what works and what doesn't work? And it's that list, it's that dream, it's that vision that people are expressing that is the beginning of our work in terms of creating an alternative. So my personal journey has been that I spent an awful lot of time over the last 20 years, it'll be 21 years later this year, since the practice of restorative circles first began to develop in the shantytowns here in Rio, starting with young people, a group of kids 7 or 8 years old. Those were the people who I first started working with. That's where this practice came from, now occurring in almost 30 countries around the world, education departments, court systems, police systems, happening in families, happening in businesses, happening in trade unions, in activist groups, happening in religious communities, happening in so many diverse environments. But it started with a group of kids, just the kinds of kids that you'd meet if you went into any schoolyard. So my personal experience has been with sitting with so many people over all these years and listening to them expressing their dreams of what we would be doing if we were doing what they understand would be best, would be most effective. That's what we build, and that's what I call a restorative system. It's a series of agreements, understandings about what we do when that red flag goes up. So I've learned that all my good ideas, all my presumptions of what would be good for people, all the clever books I've read, all the fantastic, fascinating people I've read, they all contribute to my understanding. But fundamentally, if I'm joining a community from a restorative perspective, I'm joining them as a learner and as a listener. Not as a teacher, not as a consultant, not as an expert on what other people have done in other communities. That experience is great. It's good stuff. I recommend that everybody gets it. But it's not a substitute for connecting with the people who are right in front of me. That's, in fact, the restorative ethos. That's one of our guiding lights, is that I'm listening to the deeper meaning of what people are telling me. And I'm only sharing my experience when it's requested from within that process of listening, when it actually contributes rather than eclipses their discovery of what they want to do in the ways that are meaningful for them. So when we're building these systems, there are some key areas that I found it's really useful for me to keep in mind. If I keep my attention on these five areas, I generally find that the restorative systems that we're building together tend to have a completeness to them that allows them to sustain themselves. There's an infinite amount of understanding and detail that could go into building a restorative system. But the minimum for a system to be sustainable, I found, covers roughly these five areas. So the first area comes straight out of that third question that I've asked people. What would it be like if it was like you'd like it to be? And that is an agreement that we're going to respond restoratively, and an answer to the question, well, what does restorative mean in this particular context? What are we going to do? What are the conditions in this particular community? Let's say it's a school community. What are the conditions to create a space where it's safe to speak the truth, even those uncomfortable, disruptive truths? What are the conditions to create a space that is ever more circular? What does it mean to us to really dialogue so that we're moving forwards in our understanding together? What does it mean to create a process that will be accessible to everyone in the school community, no matter their height, no matter their life experience, no matter their ethnicity, no matter their way of understanding their own gender or the way that other people understand their gender, no matter their social background, their bank balance, no matter their second name, no matter their accent, all the infinite ways in which we're distinguished from each other. what would it be like to create a space that was accessible to everybody, despite their age and their height and the name that they generally go under when they're in that building, despite the social role they play in the system called the school? The next thing that I found it's really useful to focus my attention on is, where will we do this practice that we're going to develop? But notice, we're not presuming that we already know what restorative circles are going to look like in this community. We're presuming quite the opposite. We're presuming that restorative circles will be developed by this community in a way that is unique and meaningful to it. They might borrow and learn off other people's experience, and if I have experience, I won't be shy in sharing it. I want them to be able to skip through lots of the phases that it took me years to work out how to move through, so they can get there even faster than I did. But again, I don't want their experience, my experience, to eclipse their own learning and questioning. So once we've done that, I want to know, where is this going to happen? What would a dedicated space to do this look like? And how would we set that space up so that it is distinctive? So it's really clear, this isn't a classroom. This, we may be using the library when the library's not being used for something else, because maybe in our school we don't have any other free space. But when we move into it and use it this way, it's not just a library. It's become something else. We may only have a corridor. We may be in some part of the schoolyard, either protected from the rain or protected from the sun if we're in Brazil. But we know that that particular space, even if it's all we've got, for that time, is being used in a different way. So we're going to set it up in a way that recognizes that. We're going to try and create the very, very best conditions for people to be able to experience that their presence and their contribution is valued, that they can hear each other, that they can speak and be heard, and that the result of the process has its value, and that's valued by the whole community. So the way we set up the room and the way we treat the people as they move into the room, these are really key plates. So that's the second precondition for a restorative system. First, the agreement and what we're actually going to do, and then the space itself. The third one is that I've noticed all around the world, wherever I go, and anywhere I've gone in Brazil, any different institutions and communities, people of all different ages, all different backgrounds, ideologies, religious, political beliefs, ethnic heritage, all the different ways in which they identify themselves as being distinct, they all have community-owned circle processes. Maybe it's a wedding, maybe it's a funeral, maybe it's a party, maybe it's a particular folk form, a particular form of dance or gathering, a particular way of debating, a particular way of acting in concert together as a community when something really serious happens. These are all circle processes. And these circle processes have hosts. All of them have someone who hosts them. You have a DJ at the party, you have some religious figure at the wedding or at the funeral. There's always someone who's holding the space, and often that person is holding that space through doing one of two things, or perhaps both. They're connecting us to a particular set of values, and they're asking us questions. In a restorative practice, I've found that it's the same. It's very, very supportive to have a host. Maybe we call that host a facilitator, maybe we call them a mediator, there's all kinds of terms for them. But fundamentally what they're doing is they're hosting the circle. And the way in which they host is very much influenced by the degree to which they are inspired and supported to do the practice that the community has asked them to do. So in our experience in Brazil and other places where we've done this work, being a facilitator of restorative practice is not fundamentally about skill, and it doesn't fundamentally depend on training. It's fundamentally about your willingness to be able to ask questions that seed dialogue, the willingness to be able to focus our attention on what I call omnipartiality, on the unique perspective of each voice in the circle, not pretending that we're not swayed by different voices, but also not trying to create a kind of fictional neutral space, a fictional space of being in some way impartial. It's a useful idea to talk about impartiality, but if I'm honest, in 20 years of doing this work, I've never been partial. I've never sat in a restorative practice and not been touched or swayed by things that I've heard. I've never sat there and not thought, oh my goodness, I said exactly the same thing a month ago. Or, oh my goodness, he said exactly the same thing to me 10 years ago. I'm constantly being reminded of my own life. I'm constantly being reminded that I'm not a neutral party at all. I'm impacted by what happened, and I'm impacted by what's going to happen next. Because now I'm connected to these people. I'm not someone who's come in from the outside. I'm increasingly a member of this community, if only if I discover that through conflict. That might be the only way in which it's revealed to me. But that's often a very intimate and direct way of realizing that you care about these people. You share risk with them. So the third precondition is to seek ways in which we can support, sustain, and inspire these hosts or facilitators. And yeah, maybe that is going to involve some training, if that's the particular way in which you share knowledge in your community. But for me, it's been very important to realize that training is not the fundamental characteristic that people who facilitate circles need. The fundamental characteristic is that they need support in order to be able to track meaning, to track the co-creation of meaning, and to be able to focus their attention on people's ability to be able to dialogue, and to do that in a way which sustains and deepens the dialogue, but doesn't actually interfere in a way which suggests that they're there to take responsibility for other people's well-being, to save anyone, to teach anyone anything, to get people to say certain things, or to reach some kind of preconceived ending to the encounter. Because again, if we're dialoguing, we don't know where we're going. We don't know where the end is. It's a conversation between equals whose ending is unknown. The fourth precondition, the fourth area of attention that I found it's really important to give some thought to and to translate that thought into practice, is making sure that everybody in the particular community that is using that practice understands that the practice exists and understands how to engage with it. So I've seen lots of schools where their first response to beginning to build restorative systems was to make some posters or to make a big, beautiful mural on the wall. And maybe they'll do some Googling and they'll find out a little bit about the history of restorative justice and restorative practices, and they'll put some images up, and you know, they'll find pretty pictures of people from cultures that are exotic to them sitting in circles in ways that they find evocative and meaningful. And if that's what you do, if that's what inspires you and informs you, okay, that's what you do. But I found that that information is not really the key piece. The key piece is actually much simpler. And it's very much like that piece of paper that's in the seat pocket in front of you when you're sitting in an airplane that tells you what to do if something goes wrong. It's a set of very clear instructions on what to do and where to go in order to be able to create maximum safety for everybody. In some countries, there is a piece of paper that is, by law, stuck onto the wall, close to the door, often close to the light switch. It describes what you should do in case you hear the fire alarm. Or it describes some basic first aid information that you need in case someone is ill. I'm not sure if that's the case in the country that you're in the classrooms that you're in, but I imagine there's something similar somewhere. Very clear instructions on what to do. Well, that's the kind of information that I want everybody in the community to have access to when I'm talking about this fourth area of concern, making sure that everyone knows exactly what to do from the moment in which conflict is observed, from the moment in which that conflict becomes painful or in some way dangerous. The fifth area to focus our attention on is, okay, so someone has noticed that conflict is occurring. Now what do? How do they wave that red flag? How do they alert the system that we need to put into action that restorative response that we created for ourselves? So how do I actually access this restorative system? And I have a wonderful model for that, a model that it'll maybe take many, many years, maybe I won't live to see us actually finally achieve this. And it's the model of that phone number. Every country has one. Some countries it's 999, some countries it's 911. There's a phone number that anybody can ring from any telephone. It's a free number, 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and it gets you directly to the emergency services that you need. And that's a fantastic thing. Now, what happens next after you call the fire brigade or the ambulance or the police? That's another question. But just the existence of being able to ring those services and not having to pay for it and not being asked what your age is or if you have a college degree or what your job is or what part of town you're from or anything like that, just being asked, what is the address that we need to get to in order to respond to your call? That's a fantastic model. So in the school, I want some homemade version of that. I want a really simple way that everybody can action to inform the facilitators, the hosts of this process, that it's time to set up the conditions for a restorative gathering because someone has identified conflict. Maybe they're the author of the act that has caused pain or fear. Maybe they're the person who's taken the direct impact of that. Or maybe they're a member of the wider community who are indirectly impacted. Whoever they are, they need to be able to get access to it. So these are the five areas that I found are really useful when we're building a restorative system. Making the agreement about responding restoratively and what that actually means in practice. That's the first one. Finding a dedicated space in which we can gather to do that. That's the second. Nurturing and supporting the people who will host these gatherings. That's the third. Making sure that everybody in the wider community that owns and will use this process knows exactly what it is that's going on and how to access it. That's the fourth. And then the fifth is actually creating that access point. What button do I need to push? Where do I need to go? Where do I need to sign my name in order to indicate that conflict has occurred? So when those five pieces are in place, in most of the places that I've worked in, certainly all the schools that I can remember right now, the restorative response has been effective and consistent. And it's not just been a different way of creating the conditions for justice. It's been a process that people in the community look at and say, that in itself is just. And that's why we trust that the outcomes are likely to be just as well. And for many people, that's become really, really important. Perhaps the main way in which we manage to promote our argument that restorative practices are a necessary rediscovery within society is our ability to be congruent with the values that orient restorative practices. The more restorative we are ourselves as we go about bringing this work to different communities, rediscovering it from within these communities, nurturing the flame of it that already exists within these communities and institutions, the more we're able to do that in a way which reflects the values themselves, they found the more effective we are. This is what... I've forgotten what I was going to say. yikes. It's a complicated term and I've forgotten it. Let's see if it comes back to me. No, it's not coming back to me. Anyway, Gandhi had a really nice term for this, and I've forgotten what it was. But it was a way of describing a particular...
Satyagraha?
No, it was a simpler term than that, but I've forgotten.
Uh-huh.
It was a way of responding to a particular situation in which you don't simply analyze and point out the internal contradictions in the way things currently are, but at the same time, you promote an alternative. Prefigurative. That was the term that was used. Prefigurative politics. So that you're not simply saying, look, your current way of responding to conflict in the school community is really not working. Can you see how much energy and damage is being caused by a punitive response? Can you see what happens when we exclude people? Can you see how our subconscious tendencies to reproduce dynamics which further the marginalization of already marginalized communities, can you see how they use the punitive system to reproduce themselves So we end up again and again excluding people who come from the same backgrounds, the same socioeconomic backgrounds, same ethnicities, same gender identities, the same different groups, and all these different distinctions that we have. It's not simply pointing out that that way of working is tragically ineffective and creating long-term, lasting, systemic damage to our society. But at the same time as we point that out, we're actually showing people directly, by the way in which we engage in these conversations, that there is an alternative way to respond. So when a restorative system is working well, we are congruent in that sense. And that makes our example very, very powerful, very, very influential to people. So again, another pause, and I'm curious what your impressions are of listening to me sharing a bit about the system. And then when we come back from the pause, I think that will be our last chunk. I'll speak a little bit about some of the dynamics that I've noticed that can be useful when we're facilitating. And then our time will be done.
Thank you so much, Dominic, and just welcoming you to join the conversation. Please press 1 on your telephone keypad, and I know that we had people that we didn't get to in the last conversational period, so we'll do our best to do that with about 13 minutes, I believe, that we have remaining together this evening. So let's see here. Welcome, Barb. Welcome. You are live, and let us know where you're dialing in from tonight.
Thank you. Central New York, and I just really want to thank you, Dominic, for reminding me of many of the things that Duke DeShire told our group when we started our restorative process. He came in and talked with us for a number of days, and really you refreshed all the important aspects that we had forgotten, like getting that open system, and I guess that was the biggest one. So that will be my new mission going forth very shortly.
Wonderful, Babs.
Thank you, Barb. And did you want to mention by any chance where it is that you're serving?
It's City Bosie's in Oswego, New York, Central New York.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Barb. See, Wolf, I'm going to open up your mic. Welcome, Wolf.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello.
Oh, my goodness. This will be a very short one. I just want to thank you, Dominic, so much. You know already how much I love you, and I can't really find the words, but I think you will feel the meaning of how much virtually every word that you say, how it fills me with awe and inspiration and really motivates me to keep on doing the work I do. I just couldn't help myself. I had to say thank you again.
I'm smiling from ear to ear hearing your voice after so long.
Oh my God, I love you, Dominic. Oh my God, it's so, like, you're like better than you are. Like the food you love so much, and then you think, oh, I got to go eat that amazing food, and then you go and eat it, and it's way better than you had hoped. That's what you're like.
Thank you, Wolf. And see, Eileen, welcome. Eileen.
Hi. I am just, I guess I have to just echo what that man just said, because I am really struggling. I'm just a community member. I'm not a teacher. I'm not anything. I'm just a concerned citizen who's trying to learn about this and bringing it to my community and trying to figure out how, I mean, we're just not doing that in our school district. And even just humans being together doing whatever we're doing, whether it's in, you know, church groups, synagogue groups, people trying to work on the criminal justice system. And it's hard. I mean, I'm trying to advocate for this, and your words have really inspired me about how to be more coming from an inquiring place and less of a, we need to do this, because people look at me like, what are you talking about? And they just close off. So thank you so much for giving me some different ways to think about how I might begin to introduce these ideas in a way that maybe people will be more curious about it.
That's wonderful, Eileen. I'm so happy. And I want to suggest that these days, restorative work has spread so far and wide that there may well be someone not nearly as far away from you as you imagine who's sitting there with the same kind of dilemmas that you have. And so I would really encourage you to just to put the word out in some way that you're open to partnering with people or learning from people or finding out if there's anyone who's tried to do anything locally like this. Because often I find that there are people, quite often they've actually given up. They really, really were alone, maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago trying to do this. And these days, we're really not so alone. So I very much hope that that is the case for you, and you can find some people close to you who'd be willing to form some kind of mutual support network so that you could do this together and support each other, because I find that maintaining this openness is something that I struggle to do if I don't have a support system.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Eileen and everyone gathered, when we post our post-live session resources and the audio, I'm also going to be posting different resources, including, of course, the restorativecircles.org website that has listings of local groups around the world, and also might recommend the clickable map at restorativejusticeontherise.org. But let's get back to opening up the mic. Elizabeth, I know you've been waiting a bit. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I actually, now there's been so much information, my brain is just swimming, which is a good thing. I think what I had originally wanted to talk about or share or ask is I'm an educator, and I have been introduced to circle keeping through a community of circle keepers, and after that experience have gradually transitioned and brought circle into my classroom. And that is a beautiful resonating process with the children. And your words tonight just bring that yearning of how I bring that alive more often every day through the day. And it is such a struggle. I think David expressed it so well, and your responses to him, you know, acknowledged the struggle. And I love that the struggle is not seen as a negative. It's an opportunity for our growth. I just continue to commit to that struggle, I guess, is what I'm thinking after tonight's presentation of how to increase it, because it is swimming upstream. It is coming up against the wall every day, more from outside influences who don't understand what. Well, and I really think the time for the dialogue, the whole tonight's presentation focuses on that critical element of dialogue, but that requires time and energy. And so
for me, Elizabeth, it requires support.
Yeah, and maybe stepping back and building more of that instead of just expecting people to see the good in this and jump in is a good place
yes.
for me to think of things.
Yes, I really want to make that so clear to everybody listening. I don't do anything on my own. I don't even get onto a call like this on my own. It's super scary. I don't know loads of you. I don't know what you're thinking.
Right.
You know, I might say something that I really regret, but it's being recorded, and I don't know what's going to happen to the recordings afterwards and who's going to listen to them. So there are all kinds of things, and that's what I feel like when I'm going into a circle to facilitate. It's also what I feel like when I'm going to a circle because I'm the author of a particular act, or because I'm the receiver of an act, or because I'm a community member. It's what I feel like when I stand up and share my work or talk about it, or when I start to build systems. So for all these things, I find that it's so important to have a community of people who will listen to us in ways that give us the energy and the clarity to be able to do our work in the way that we want to do it, so that there's that congruence between what we're saying and what we're actually doing. So I agree with you that it does involve all kinds of resources. But the fundamental one for me has also been the one that no one ever explained to me, which is that I need support. So I offer that to you, Elizabeth, and hope that will and allow you to take whatever wonderful work you're doing to the next step.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Dominic, would it be okay to open up the mic for one more person? We have
Please
a lot of hands
that.
Up tonight. Thank you. And thank you to everybody for holding space for probably the likely probability of us running slightly over tonight. It's very important to be very careful with your time and value it. But if you can stay with us, we'll take another question, comment, and then I think Dominic has a bit more to share before we close tonight. So, Martha, welcome. Opened up your mic, Martha. Are you?
I think that's me. Lee?
Yes, that's you,
Martha. Yes, Dominic. I'm calling from Vermont, and I have felt very validated for the work I do in a middle school, high school, and by everything you have shared tonight, and I'm particularly impressed with how you say it, the language, the definition of dialogue, all the definitions you've shared tonight. I have systematically put in place at our school circles, intrigued with restorative practices coming from New Zealand and different research I have done, and we now walk towards conflict in a way that we established a protocol peer review circles for any what you called infraction. We say violations of these five basic guidelines we have, and the peers themselves write a plan that is asking for support. The questions you have mentioned in this session tonight, asking for support and asking for 5 days of monitoring and recognition of changes they are attempting to make to change their behavior. And I developed a department called the Resource Response Department that kind of takes in your five ways of implementing a systematic restorative practice. And we have a call center. We have, well, several of the things you talked about, but I just want to tell you how important this conversation that you've had with us tonight is for me.
That's wonderful, Martha. I'm so happy to see that that's happening in Vermont. I remember being there, it must be almost 10 years ago now, and so much enthusiasm about bringing this work in, but it was still just beginning, and it's wonderful to hear the feedback about how much things are developing.
Oh, great. When you talk about the circular space, we've gone as far as put tennis balls under every chair and every table in every classroom in our school, so that if we as the facilitators come in because we've had gotten that call, right in a classroom we can form a circle. So we have this safe way, this, like you say, it's the greatest equalizer to form a circle. We can do it anywhere, in a hallway, in the cafeteria now, and it's accepted.
Fantastic.
It is. But what's fantastic is to know that you're out there and that this is continuing to be looked at in this global way, because it could be the way.
Well, I'm celebrating that after 20 years of work here, in December, the National Council of Justice here, which is part of the federal justice system in Brazil, announced that from this year on, all the youth court processes in Brazil will need to develop restorative practices. So we're reaching a degree of implementation on a systemic level here. We've still got a lot to do, of course, but we're reaching a degree which really was hard to imagine when we began 20 years ago. And I think that many places in the world are seeing similar shifts. We've had whole statewide education departments here, for instance, the department here in Rio, where I am, wanting to implement restorative practices throughout all high schools, and having all kinds of difficulty in doing that. But just the fact that we're beginning to move from projects to programs, and then from programs to public policy, is very exciting. And if it can happen here with all the struggles we have here, then it can certainly happen in places where the resources are much more abundant, as they are in many places in the U.S. and Europe.
Hmm. Well, Dominic, we are coming just a little bit over our time now. Would you like to move into a closing? And wonderful.
I think to close, I'd like to invite three mini reflections of things that I've seen that have happened during circles. And that I believe are not so much ideas from a particular restorative practice, but more dynamics that belong to the nature of conflict. They're as if they were the forces that are emergent or attempting to be emergent whenever we create a space that's safe for dialogue. And one of them is that when something painful has happened that has torn into some relationship or distanced people or broken an experience of trust between people, it's often assumed that we should immediately start looking at what happened. And yet, in many occasions like this that I've observed, before we do that, we actually need to recover our ability to be able to hear each other. It's like the shock of separation or something painful having happened diminishes our ability to hear. We actually aren't able to understand what the other person is saying with the same clarity that we normally would have. And so in the restorative practices that we've developed and found effective, before we actually look at what happened, what we'll do is spend some time just recovering our ability to listen to each other. So checking that it's possible to clearly share a message. So that's one piece that maybe you'd like to bear in mind. Another is that when we look at what happened from a restorative perspective, we're not looking at it through the lens that we've become so used to, where we're seeking to find out who did the wrong thing so that we know how to respond. Sometimes an initial understanding of restorative practices believes that the change that restorative practices bring is in how we respond to identifying the wrong thing. Perhaps before we responded punitively, and now we're going to respond in some more constructive means. But my understanding of the offer that restorative practices is making to us and to our communities, and particularly school communities, because they're so much the place where young people learn society, learn how to interact in a mini society of a school community. Particularly in these environments, restorative practices are inviting us to a more transformative potential, in my understanding. So the change is not from a punitive response to a more constructive response. It's actually a change from seeing people as having done wrong things and being defined by the wrong things they've done, to seeing people have attempted to express something in a way that has been tragically ineffective. So when I'm listening to what it was that was done, what I'm fundamentally interested in is not so much the act in itself. What I'm fundamentally interested in is the meaning that it had for each of the people involved, the meaning that it had for the person who acted, the meaning that their reaction had when they received the impact of what was done, the meaning that was below the reaction that the wider the community had. So I invite you to listen to the meaning behind what was done and see if we can discover what that was trying to express, so that we avoid the possibility that we might accidentally reinforce the idea that there are behaviors that should be off limits to curiosity, off limits to inquiry. Because when we do that, we can sometimes accidentally reinforce repressive dynamics that are already existent and perhaps even dominant in society. And accidentally our restorative practices will reinforce exclusion, they'll reinforce separation, they'll repeat the same dynamics of privilege and marginalization that we so urgently need to transform, and that schools are such an incredibly potent environment for transforming. And the third and final piece, which again, just like the other two things I've said, is not something new. Everybody listening, I'm sure, already knows this. But I want to invite us to look at it perhaps even more deeply and see if there's not more restorative outcome that we can bring from it. And that is the action plans that we build at the end of our restorative processes. Sometimes those action plans slip into a habit which is very common in schools, where we make vague promises to those who are asking us to change, and those who are asking us to change don't then follow up to see if those vague promises have actually been enacted. So in a restorative practice, I want to make sure that we get really specific about the agreements for action that we create. I want to make sure that those agreements are not vague promises, but they describe really specific, doable, measurable things that have a time frame to be put in place. Because only when we have a time frame on our action plans can we gather together in what we call the post circle and actually evaluate not whether those things have been done, but evaluate whether well-being has been created. Because sometimes even our best, most creative action plans don't create the change that we desire. So the important thing is not even in the end whether we actually do what we said we'd do. The important thing is to find out if, by doing what we said we'd do, we create the change we want. And if those action plans are not put in place, to look at that phenomena restoratively as well and to ask ourselves, well, what impeded you actually making the change that previously you had elected to do, that you wanted to do? So by looking carefully about the way we get on the same page when we meet, by looking carefully at the deeper meaning of what was done and not being distracted by the idea that what was done was a breaking of a rule, and then by looking very, very practically at how we can change not just behavior, but the conditions that make particular behavior painful, I found that we can really deepen the degree of restorativity of our current practice. So that's really what I wanted to share, and I want to thank Molly and all of you for being part of this conversation, and thank you to all the people who spoke up and all the people who, by remaining silent, allowed me and the others to speak. Thank you very much for that choice, which created the conditions for us to have this conversation. I really encourage you to be part of the conversation. You can find me on Facebook. Restorative Circles is there as both a group, which is more open to discussion. It's also there as a page where I will post occasional texts, videos, and other information about this work. If you want to ask questions and get into dialogue with me, probably the best way to do that is through Twitter. So you can go to @RestorerCircles. And I don't post a lot, but I generally post one or two things every day. On Facebook, maybe one thing a week. Or you can go to the restorativecircles.org website, as Molly also mentioned. And I look forward to continuing the dialogue with you.
Well, I just want to, again, just thank you so much, Dominic, for your time this evening with us and really for everything that you're sharing with our world in the way that you share it. And thank you so much to everyone. This is a community of learning. And I'm going to be opening up our mics in just a moment to say goodnight. And want to thank the Peace Alliance and NACRJ once again. And also just a reminder that next week for session 4, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Mara Schiff and Nancy Charles from the Orange County Public School District in Florida. The title of their session is Cool Water for a Thirsty District, Implementing Restorative Practices in Orange County Public Schools, OCPS, in Florida. Now, the slide that you're looking at, if you're on our screen share tonight, gives you a little bit more detail about that session upcoming next week. And again, a reminder to go to our main website page where you can access all of the audios, all of the resources, including, of course, all the great information and sharing that Dominic has provided and shared with us tonight will be posted at that page, including a link to the Facebook group that he mentioned and so forth. It's been my pleasure on behalf of the Peace Alliance and ACRJ and Restorative Circles, excuse me, as well as Dominic Barter, to be with you tonight. And looking forward to seeing you next week. I'm Molly Rowan Leach, and have a great night, everyone. I'm going to open up all of our mics now so that we can say goodnight.
Hey.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.